sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is filmmaker Arnon Shore, whose new short movie is The Pirate Captain Toledano, discussing Jewish pirates. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshinim, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We are well along in the process of the counting of the Omer on the Jewish calendar now, the time between Passover, Festival of Freedom, and Shavuot, the Festival of Covenant and receiving the Torah at Mount Sinai. This coming week, the minor Jewish holiday of Lag BaOmer is observed, and its history and rituals require some explanation. Lag BaOmer is named for when it falls. Since Hebrew letters also have numeric significance, the 33rd day of the counting of the Omer comes out as Lamed Gimel, which is therefore pronounced Lag, you know, Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day of the Omer. The historical significance of the day is rather obscure, perhaps dating back to a plague that affected the students of the great Rabbi Akiva, the 2nd century, which the Talmud says ended on this date. That probably was a carefully disguised allusion to the failure of the Bar Kokhba revolt against Rome back in that century, which Rabbi Akiva supported with disastrous consequences for both himself and his disciples. A more attractive and more popular rationale for this holiday of Lag BaOmer is that the period of the counting of the Omer is a time of some asceticism for observant Jews. Certain pleasures are restricted, beards are not shaved, and hair is not cut. Weddings are legally prohibited. These rules are associated with mystical traditions that, in this period, we try to purify our actions and our intentions in preparation for symbolically again receiving the Ten Commandments, the Torah, at Mount Sinai. The famous mystical Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, also from the 2nd century, hid from the Romans with his son in a cave near Mount Meron at a place called Pekiin, miraculously surviving there for 12 years. It was on Lag BaOmer that he emerged, according to tradition, having written the greatest mystical text of all, the Zohar. Because of that, Lag BaOmer is a day when the restrictions of this period are lifted, and weddings are permitted and performed all day. Lag BaOmer is actually celebrated in Israel with huge bonfires and barbecues, games and contests. Among the mystically oriented Orthodox Jews, both Ashkenazic and Sephardic, Lag BaOmer is a time of pilgrimage to the north of Israel, to Mount Meron and Tzfat, and of heightened spirituality. And for American Jews, it's a good time to celebrate with an outdoor experience of Judaism, connecting us both to mystical origins and to our enduring gratitude to the Creator of the universe. To play us in this morning, here's David Derry's recording of Bar Yochai for Shimon Bar Yochai and Lag BaOmer this coming Wednesday night and Thursday. Bar Yochai, nimshachta asrecha, shemetzazon mechaberecha. Bar Yochai, nimshachta asrecha, shemetzazon mechaberecha. Bar Yochai,
אתה שרה איך הרב הוצאת מיתרה שלבת נגד צוררת.
That was David Derry singing Bar Yochai for Lag BaOmer, coming up Wednesday night and Thursday. Our guest this morning, filmmaker Arnon Shor, got interested in an obscure but fascinating piece of Jewish history, the Hebrew Buccaneers of the Spanish Main. His short film, The Pirate Captain Toledano, has just been released. Learn all about it and about Jewish pirates when we come back here in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish. Our guest this morning, Arnon Shor, is the creator of the new film Pirate Captain Toledano, exploring Jewish pirates. He's a filmmaker with other interesting shorts in his career. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So why Jewish pirates?
Well, that's a good question. Why not?
Good answer. I think that for many viewers, the concept of Jews as pirates will seem quite alien. You know, some of us who like history, you've heard of Jean Lafitte and know vaguely that Jews who were expelled from Spain got involved. But tell us a little bit about the background and why it's such an interesting subject.
Sure. Like you said, the Spanish Inquisition pushed a lot of Jews out of Spain to all corners of the world. And not coincidentally, at the same time, because of the European discovery of the New World with Columbus's voyage, there was a lot of interest in perhaps establishing some kind of safe haven, some kind of beachhead in the New World for Jews, for refugees. Since a lot of Jews at the time were involved in maritime pursuits and in trade, it was a kind of a natural fit for Jews to, for some of the Jews who fled the Inquisition, to take to the high seas. And among those, it seems, according to some historians, that there were some Jews who took to piracy, both as a means of survival and as a means to strike back. If you were a pirate and you were attacking the you know, whoever had the treasure fleets and the most resources in the 16th century, 17th century, but especially 16th, you were primarily attacking Spanish ships. They were the maritime superpower. So it was a way to try to get a little vigilante justice, to strike back against the oppressor. That's the basic history. And the fact that people generally don't know about it, the fact that it seems so surprising, is one of the reasons that I wanted to make the film. It seemed like there have been lots of pirate movies, there have been a handful of pirate TV shows, but there has never been a Jewish pirate depicted on screen. So I set out to change that with my short film.
It's a very interesting film, and we'll talk about the inner workings of it, and also sort of the implications of Jews as pirates. So we come back with Arnon Shor in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our Shin Shinim, Tamir Shakuri and Chen Dinachi, representing the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
You know, there's a, I think for most American Jews, there's not a very clear understanding of the social distinctions that used to exist in Israel between Jews, not just between Jews and Arabs, but among Jews themselves. Ashkenazic Jews, German Jews, as opposed to other Ashkenazic Jews and Sephardic Jews, Jews from Morocco, Jews from Yemen, then the Jews came from Ethiopia, Russian Jews. There, people keep some of that identity still. Is there still, even in your generation, some sense of those differences?
So I feel like in the past few generations, people have like really struggled with their identity because they used to be Italians or French or Moroccan. And then they came to Israel and they became Israelis, which meant that they had to ditch and leave behind every sense of identity that they had in the past. It was part of the process that happened in Israel. It was called a melting pot. They were trying to create this new Israeli and...
And the new Jew, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the new agricultural Jew that doesn't speak Moroccan or... Well,
the Arabic.
Arabic.
There's a lot of different Arabic, right?
So that's a thing that happened. And for example, when my grandma came to Israel from Morocco, she like didn't teach her kids any of her culture because she didn't want them to know. Like, she wanted them to be the new Israeli. She didn't want them to be Moroccan. And I think now it's actually... The reverse process is happening because people are re-embracing their identity. People are, it's like high school where you want to fit in. And then the second you get out of high school, you just want to stand out. It's just like that. So we're done fitting in. And now like people really try to celebrate the differences. But I think you can still probably see just a little bit of traces from the discrimination that it used to happen. I think our generation will overcome it when we're adults, but you can still see a little bit like from today's adults. So
Tamir, you know, Chen has kind of a mixed background, if you will. Yours is not so mixed. Tell us a little bit about your perceptions on this.
So I just want to start and say that, I think one of the first questions that you're being asked in Israel is, it's like, how old are you? What did you do in the army? And what's your ethnicity? It's kind of like every country has their own order. I bet in America you ask, where'd you go to college first or something like that.
Right, unless you're in the South. And then in the South, they ask you, and what church do you go to?
Yeah, so it's like, it's the common question that you get. So yep. In Israel, being asked about your ethnicity is a very common question. And being all Moroccan from both sides, it's kind of... sometimes I get, you don't look very Moroccan, or you don't act like a Moroccan. And I'm like, so am I supposed to have it on my forehead or something?
Like, supposed to be like Casablanca? I mean, what are you, how was it proved?
I don't know, but I feel like we are overcoming the differences. And, well, for me, one day it kind of got all clear when my mom met all of her brothers. She has 5 siblings, and we all met at this, we had dinner together, and they were starting to watch Moroccan stand-up comedy, mm-hmm. and they were laughing, and they were like remembering how it was growing up in Morocco, and I was kind of sad. It was like when I was 10 or something. So I told my mom, mom, like, can you teach me some Moroccan so that I won't lose it, so I can tell it to my kids? It was kind of funny. She was so excited. She almost cried. I told her that it's kind of sad that I won't be able to use like the little Moroccan that she still has. I won't be able to use it myself. So it's kind of sad because I feel like I'm losing all of the history.
Losing the tradition. Yeah.
But I'm working on it. I think it's really interesting and fascinating to hear about the culture in Morocco.
You know, and Israel is really country of people who are second, first generation immigrants, often second, third generation, not very far back, obviously. So reviving that without creating cultural lines of differences is also very important. Thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
The Boy Scouts of America have gone through many changes over the last 5 years, and you may not know about them. The Boy Scouts now include boys who are members of the LGBT community and leaders from the LGBT community. Just last year, a pilot program for boys 5 years old and in kindergarten was added, and a family program for girls 5 through 9 years old who can now join Cub Scouts. A key Boy Scout law says a scout is reverent and duty to God is now a component for scout rank. Interfaith prayer is used whenever members of multiple faiths are present. In the early 70s, some Jewish organizations dropped sponsorship of scouting because of the lack of inclusion, but it's time for the Jewish community to return to its support for this great organization. Judaism shares principles that are represented and taught by the Boy Scouts of America. Scouting's a great place to inculcate good values and a shared philosophy, develop better adjusted and contributing young people who will become future leaders. Scouting is more than camping. It's a variety of activities promoting physical and mental health and emotional growth. Scouting schedules activities so as not to interfere with religious and other family activities and to include other members of the nuclear family. Scouting's an enhancement of religious, communal, and familial life. And that's true from the youngest level of scouting. Currently, only one unit chartered by a Jewish organization, PAC 613 in Tucson, exists in the state of Arizona. If you are in the Tucson area, contact Herb at Shofarman, S-H-O-F-A-R-M-A-N, at AOL.com, or call the Catalina Council at 520-750-0385. That's 750-0385. New members are very welcome in the scouting family. Scouting's there for all members, in good times and bad, helping in every way. Contact the Scouting Council in your area. Go to www.beascout.org or www.my.scouting.org. Ask your local council if they have a Jewish committee on scouting who can come to your synagogue or organization and see if scouting is just the thing to further your mission to the community. You can also contact the National Jewish Committee on Scouting, www.jewishscouting.org. Scouting is great for you and your family.
We are exploring Israel's 70th anniversary, 70 years, to be biblical about it, with a special Two Jewish ongoing feature, a look at each decade of Israel's existence from 1948 to 2018 through a headline from that year and a signature melody. And so, this morning, we continue the process of reviewing the history of the Jewish state, 70 years of Israel in 7 weeks, on to decade 7, believe it or not, with a headline from the 2000s. While one of the most dramatic headlines from Israel was Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's sudden stroke and incapacitation, that wasn't the most important event of the 2000s. Instead, it was the headline that wasn't that mattered from about, 2008 or so. You see, the headline you won't see from 2007 or 8 or 9 in Israel was the one you saw in every other developed country. The huge financial crash of the real estate and mortgage lending disaster that severely damaged the United States and all of Europe. But the booming Israeli economy of the 2000s never experienced a real recession, unlike us, instead continuing its long transition into a successful first world country. Throughout the decade, in spite of wars in Lebanon with Hezbollah, withdrawal from Gaza and subsequent wars with Hamas there, and endemic terrorism and threats, Israel's technological and infrastructure boom, well, vast expansion anyway, continued unabated. It was in the 2000s that Israel became officially Startup Nation, so-called for incubating so many high-tech, internet security, medical technology, and other firms, many of which sold for higher and higher prices on the global market or had very successful IPOs. By the end of the 2000s, you pretty much expected every Israeli to say that he or she worked in high tech, unless they just opened up a new boutique winery or a spa in the Galilee. Israel's prosperity, while not as evenly spread around as you might hope, continues right up till today. By the way, in 2009, Bibi Netanyahu was elected prime minister, returning to the office he had held briefly in the 1990s. He is still there, at least as of the current broadcast. Our song for the decade of the 2000s comes from Idan Reichel, perhaps the best musical example of the remarkable diversity of Israeli society and the inclusion in the increasingly prosperous country of interesting and diverse cultural elements. This was Idan Reichel's breakthrough hit, Boi.
Basta metali begiseu sta chauteng sa chautex sta wayin sa wayin sinetakakaf kan bakan gizeu mbedesta sinasalef kanu simesh macheno adis kanemi jemero bebabal sinelay kaftoy sinegenay betam desta emisamay ahun ya hullu walefna kazidaras kazidaras kazidaras
boy miliat fenele אל תשאלי אותי לאן, תשאלי אותי על אושר. אולי גם הוא יבוא, כשהוא יבוא ירד עלינו כמו גשם. בואי נתחבק ונלך, אל תשאלי אותי מתי, אל תשאלי אותי על בית, אל תבקשי ממני זמן.
Is our seventh weekly Two Jewish Celebration, 70 Years of Israel in 7 weeks, memories from the headlines of the 2000s. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You recently returned from a visit to Spain, which has a phenomenal Jewish history and past, which is now beginning to merge into something of a Jewish present.
Yes, I had an extremely interesting experience. I went actually to Malaga because a close Argentinian friend, who's also a wine person and makes his living in wine and is very passionate about it, and I've known for a long time.
By the way, that was a Jewish trade, and I know. In Spain, Germany, lots of places.
So this guy and his wife live and work actually in two different cities. So during the week, he stays in an apartment in the center of Malaga with her aunt, and on weekends, he drives to their joint apartment near Jaén, which I did not visit, but spent a lot of time during the weekend when Anna wasn't working with both of them, and during the week with him, especially in the evenings. So he fixed up for me to go to the cities that I most wanted to see, which were three: Granada, Sevilla, and Cordoba. And I, you know, like to think of myself as somebody who knows a lot about Jewish history, but I was really overwhelmed by the richness of the Jewish history in these places, and particularly in Cordoba, because Cordoba has, you know, squares and streets and whole public places named after Yehuda Halevi, Maimonides, Chasta Ibn Shaprut, etc., etc. And in addition to all these place names, there's actually something called the Casa Sfarad that is privately run. It's not a public institution, so unlike public institutions, it was open on Monday, which explains who these people were, why they were important, what happened to them and their descendants, and all of that.
Sort of a converted former synagogue, perhaps, that Casa de Sfarad, as I recall, but a really interesting sort of a museum.
Well, you bring up an interesting point. It's totally a museum, and it's very educational, and they have guides who speak every language on earth. And remind me later to talk to you about this French-speaking guide I overheard.
Okay.
But it is unlikely that it's a former synagogue for the simple reason that the only building that they're sure was once a synagogue was built and used in the 14th and 15th centuries, is now closed for renovation, sponsored by the European Union in Brussels. Hmm. And they know that during the period when all these great learned Jews thrived there, which was largely the 9th and 10th century, maybe a little bit the 11th, there must have been other synagogues, but they have no record of where they were. And so nobody even presumes to tell you that this building is built on the ruins of what was once a synagogue. The oldest building that they know for sure was a synagogue was built sometime in the 1300s, around the middle, in fact, of the 14th century. And that's almost across the street from the Casa Sfarad. So it's not unreasonable to assume that the building that now houses this museum may have once had a synagogue on the same lot, but most of the synagogues were completely torn down and destroyed in actually two waves of anti-Jewish fervor, one in the 14th century and then the final one at the end of the 15th century.
And I should add that it's impossible that any Jewish community could have survived with only one synagogue anywhere in the world. Tom, thanks. We'll talk some more about Spain next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie and Bernie were well into their 80s and were still able to look after themselves in their own home. Until, that is, a police car pulled up outside their house and out stepped Bernie. The policeman who escorted Bernie to the door was kind and understanding. He explained to Sadie that Bernie told him he was lost in the park and couldn't find his way home. "Oy, Bernie," said Sadie. "How on earth did you get yourself lost? You've been going to that park for over 35 years. Bernie went up to Sadie and whispered softly in her ear, "Please don't tell the policeman. I wasn't lost. I was just too tired to walk home." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and find your way home. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Bahar, next to last in the book of Leviticus, begins with a statement that God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, that's a seemingly unambiguous phrase. The rules of holiness and personal conduct must therefore have been commanded at Mount Sinai. Yet earlier in Leviticus, it's clear God has given most of these commandments not at Mount Sinai, but in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Ohel Moed, the Tent of Meeting, as the people wander around the desert long after we left Mount Sinai and began our journey to the Promised Land. As Bahar begins, the Israelites don't actually seem to still be at Mount Sinai at all. What gives? Why say that these laws were given at Mount Sinai when clearly they weren't? The answer lies in the use of metaphor. For in the rabbinic understanding, Mount Sinai is not just a geographical location, not a simple matter of a specific place. Wherever we learn and do mitzvot, whenever we complete ethical acts, do tzedakah, observe rituals with sanctity, study Torah, or work to perfect the world, wherever and whenever we strive to make this a holier, more Jewish place, then we are standing at Sinai. As committed Jews, we take Mount Sinai with us and bring God's very presence into the world. It's a powerful message indeed. We can make our own lives as holy as the revelation at Mount Sinai simply by living Torah each and every day through our own actions. When we return to Too Jewish, our guest, Arnon Shore, will tell us why there were Jewish pirates in the first place. After all, what kind of job is that for a nice Jewish boy? And how he incorporated the lives of many real-life buccaneers into his new film, The Pirate Captain Toledano. Find out when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
There was a great deal of controversy the last couple weeks over actress Natalie Portman's refusal to come to Israel and accept the Genesis Prize, the so-called Jewish Nobel Prize. Portman, an Israeli-American Jewish actor who was born in Jerusalem and has demonstrated great pride in her Israeli identity and her Jewishness in the past, suddenly changed her mind about participating in the ceremony when she learned that Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu was going to speak. The recent violence on the Gaza border and Israel's response to it apparently influenced her decision, but Bibi was at the heart of it. As Natalie Portman said, "Let me speak for myself. I chose not to attend because I did not want to appear endorsing Benjamin Netanyahu, who was to be giving a speech at the ceremony." The Genesis Awards ceremony was canceled after Portman's withdrawal was made public. Although critics right and left attacked Natalie Portman for her decision, with comments on one side likening her position to that of anti-Semites and the supporters of BDS, and on the other side, unfavorably comparing her withdrawal to Elie Wiesel's courageous face-to-face criticism of President Ronald Reagan in the Bitburg controversy so long ago. Portman herself added, "I am not part of the BDS movement and do not endorse it," referring to the Palestinian-led global movement Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Against Israel. "Like many Israelis and Jews around the world, I can be critical of the leadership in Israel without wanting to boycott the whole nation. I treasure my Israeli friends and family, Israeli food, books, art, cinema, and dance. Israel was created exactly 70 years ago as a haven for refugees from the Holocaust. But the mistreatment of those suffering from today's atrocities is simply not in line with my Jewish values. Because I care about Israel, I must stand up against violence, corruption, inequality, and the abuse of power." She added that she still plans to use the Genesis Prize funds privately to support a number of charities in Israel, and she will announce which ones soon. Okay, so to summarize, this fairly new Genesis Prize, only awarded since 2014 and funded by Russian Jewish oligarch money, has been given to extremely wealthy and successful Jews who use the funds to help charitable organizations do work in areas they personally care about. The recipients so far have been Michael Bloomberg, Michael Douglas, Yitzhak Perlman, Anish Kapoor, and now Natalie Portman. A billionaire financial wizard, two actors, a violin virtuoso, and an author. Portman's refusal to participate in a ceremony with Bibi Netanyahu marks a low point in Genesis Prize history so far, and the cancellation of this year's ceremony is definitely not a highlight. But it must be noted that the Nobel Prize has had many lowlights in its history, too. Recipients of the Nobel Peace Prize, named after the inventor for dynamite, by the way, have included lifelong terrorist Yasser Arafat, Aung San Suu Kyi, the Burmese one-time dissident now in power, who has been accused of abetting the ethnic cleansing of Myanmar's Muslim Rohingya minority, Henry Kissinger, who authorized the secret bombing of Cambodia, among other not very peaceful actions, and Lee Duck Tho, the leader of North Vietnam, which at the time was about to finish conquering South Vietnam. He refused the award. Let us not forget Barack Obama, who still doesn't know why he received the Nobel Peace Prize when he had just been elected president for the first time and had essentially no diplomatic experience whatsoever. Well, in any case, maybe next year things will go better for the Genesis Prize. In news from Europe, solidarity marches to protest anti-Semitism took place in Berlin and other German cities last week after an attack on a man wearing a yarmulke sparked widespread outrage. The assault in Berlin, caught on video, involved a 21-year-old man wearing a Jewish kippah, a skullcap, who was suddenly attacked by an assailant calling out Yehudi, both the Arabic and Hebrew word for Jew. The victim replies, "Jew or no Jew, you have to deal with it." A 19-year-old Syrian asylum seeker later turned himself in, claiming to be the attacker. The man who suffered bruises told Deutsche Welle that he is not in fact Jewish. He is an Israeli Arab who donned the kippah as an experiment to disprove a friend who warned that it had become unsafe to wear a yarmulke in Germany. An interview by Israeli broadcaster Khan identified the 21-year-old as Israeli Adam Armush and showed that he was slightly injured. "They kept cursing us, and my friend asked them to stop cursing," Armush said. "They started to get angry, and one of them ran to me, and I knew it was important to film it because there would be no way to catch him by the time police arrived," Armush later posted the video online. The resulting backlash has prompted a groundswell of condemnation in Germany, including from Chancellor Angela Merkel. "This is quite a horrifying incident, and we will react," she said, following a meeting with German leaders last week. Merkel pointed to a disturbing rise in anti-Semitism, not only among Germans, but among the many Arabic-speaking asylum seekers who have sought refuge in Germany. Last week, a rap band included cynical references to the Nazi Auschwitz death camp in its lyrics, and it won a top German music prize, drawing strong criticism from other artists and government officials. Many past winners said they would return their awards. Following that, the German music industry group BVMI announced it is scrapping the Echo Music Prize altogether, saying that the Echo brand was so badly damaged a completely new beginning is necessary. Joseph Schuster, head of Germany's Central Council, advised individuals against showing themselves openly with a kippa in a big city setting in Germany. Wear a baseball cap or something else to cover your head instead. Among other protests, there was a Wear a Kippah campaign organized by the Berlin Jewish community and a similar protest in Erfurt, Germany. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Arnon Shore, is the maker of the new short film, Pirate Captain Toledano, about, exactly that, a Jewish pirate captain and, a stowaway, and you'll hear more about the specifics of the film. Tell us what led you into filmmaking, particularly making short films, before we go back into the movie itself.
Sure. My background is pretty typical for a filmmaker these days. I grew up on Spielberg films and was enchanted by them and entranced by the mystery of the process behind them. Got bitten by the film bug when I was very young and never got cured of it. So I've been making films basically since I was a kid. Short films in particular, well, first of all, when you're a kid and you're making movies, by and large, you're making shorts because making anything longer is cost prohibitive. But I've come to really enjoy making short films in addition to the other stuff that I do, the web series and the features and other types of media, because I find that there's an economy of storytelling that really challenges me as a filmmaker to tell as much story as efficiently as possible and to deliver as much of a narrative punch, as much of an emotional punch as I can with limited resources and, more importantly, with limited time. There isn't much time to develop real big complicated characters or complicated plots. It's a very focused way to tell a simple, clean story, and it can be very satisfying when it's done really well. Because you're in, you got the story, you're out, and you're done. It can be a lot of fun.
You know, I'm also wondering, in an era in which attention spans have crept, they've gotten smaller and smaller, maybe the short is a new vehicle for reaching people. I mean, you think about the plethora of short videos that are available everywhere online and elsewhere, and that's how people are telling their stories now. So it's
for sure. Actually, when I was kind of starting out, a lot of the short films that I made, as soon as I finished them, I put them up online. This was in the early days of YouTube and a little bit even before YouTube. And the general rule of thumb was shorter is better. So I really kind of honed my craft on this very short attention span, very short narrative space. And I actually had to kind of retrain myself a little bit when I started making short films that were intended for film festivals, which generally will project a film on a screen in a theater or a similar venue. I had to kind of slow down the pace of my editing and kind of let things breathe a little bit more, because there's a different aesthetic on a screen than on say a laptop or a cell phone.
Very interesting, visually interesting to think about the different timing of everything. Tell us about the story itself.
So the Pirate Captain Toledano tells the story of a pirate captain and a stowaway. And the stowaway is, he stows away on this pirate ship and he's caught.
And when he's caught, he tells the captain that he stowed away because he wants to become a pirate. He wants to join the crew. The pirate discovers that this stowaway is, in fact, a refugee from the Spanish Inquisition. And that influences the captain's decision as to whether or not to allow the stowaway to join the pirates or to cast him overboard, which is what was typically done with stowaways on pirate ships.
You know, that moment when he connects to a co-religionist, you know, another secret Jew in a world that's clearly not a Jewish world, is a really beautiful moment. That, I would think, is kind of the, you know, that's that shared secret. we don't think about how important that was for so long for Jews in so many places, but it's really visualized well. What influenced you in creating that?
That's a good question. And it's a question that I didn't think about when I was creating it. It was a spontaneous, creative expression. But as the film has been released and people have been asking questions about it and I've been interviewed about it, this question has come up and I've given it a lot of thought. And I think it has something to do with my own background as a bit of an outsider, you know, within a group of outsiders. I was born in Israel, but grew up primarily in the United States, in Massachusetts, in one of the Boston suburbs. So already I was a little bit different, a little bit of an outsider. But I was also I grew up outside of the Jewish community, sort of. I went to Jewish day schools, but most of my friends lived in Brookline and Newton and Sharon, the major, you know, some of the major Jewish communities in Massachusetts. But I lived outside of that. So being a little bit of an outsider, a little bit of an insider, it gave me opportunities to have these moments of recognition. You know, if I would meet a fellow Israeli-American, there was that little spark of, wait a minute, I kind of have a sense of what your experience was like in a way that most of the people around us, even the Jews around us, didn't necessarily relate to. Meeting another Hebrew speaker in America also has a little bit of that moment of, wait a minute, we share a common language that the people around us don't know. So I think I've had some of these moments in my own life of encountering people who shared almost this secret identity with me. And I think I channeled some of that into that scene, into that moment.
In the course of researching the film, which Jewish pirates caught your interest?
The one that caught my interest the most was a pirate named Samuel Palash.
Good first name, by the way. Really, really good.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a privateer for the Dutch. So he's a privateer under a letter of marque from the Dutch, which basically meant that he was a pirate with somebody's permission, as opposed to a regular pirate who just, you know, went out on his own. And the thing that struck me about his story is that when he was in Amsterdam, he was the president of his congregation. He was an active member of the Jewish community. He was religious.
You know, I've had presidents of congregations that were pirates too, but maybe not.
maybe not quite. They weren't plundering.
No, they weren't on the Spanish main plundering galleons, but yes.
So when Palash was out at sea, he had his own cook on his ship so that he could have kosher food.
Wow.
On his voyages. And the idea of somebody who was both devout and basically a pirate, was such an interesting idea to me. And it's one of the reasons that I set my film, you know, it starts out, you see the pirate captain having dinner on his own in his cabin and not with the rest of the crew. And there are a couple candles lit on his table. The idea that it's a Friday night and he's having his Shabbat dinner as a pirate, and that those ideas are not completely in conflict with one another, that juxtaposition was really interesting to me. And his character was one of the biggest influences.
It should be noted that pirates could sort of have different kinds of roles. I mean, countries commissioned, like England and Holland, commissioned captains with letters of marque, giving them the right to raid Spanish galleons as sort of an act of national service. They were semi-military employees and then they would give a cut of their take to the government. So the idea that you could both be, what we think of as, you know, kind of a wild criminal out there stealing from the Spanish, it was actually kind of a strange status, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is that the act itself is the same. The things that a pirate would do and the things that a privateer would do were pretty similar, except that the privateer had this letter of marque, you know, and this sort of official sanction. But in terms of the day-to-day, you know, you attack a ship, you attack a ship. It's the same swords, the same cannons. It has the same drama.
There was a dangerous occupation, no? I mean, what kind of job was that for a good Jewish boy?
Well, I think that you travel outside of the safety of land into the great unknown of the Atlantic Ocean for weeks and months on end before you get to any sort of port. You know, that in itself was dangerous. But remember, at the time, there were a lot of Jewish merchants. And this is also partly connected to the facts of the Inquisition and partly connected to, you know, the fact of the expulsion many years before that. Because Jews were dispersed all over the world, it meant that Jews had natural trading partners all over the world, which is one of the reasons that Jews and trade and mercantile pursuits were kind of synonymous for many hundreds of years. So Jews were traveling all over the world anyway, buying and selling merchandise and transporting it sometimes over land, sometimes by sea. The piracy aspect of it had a little bit more danger in that, you know, you're actually attacking ships and there's combat involved. But the danger of actual, you know, the travel and the harsh dealing
conditions,
with the elements and all
sure.
of that.
Illness. Right.
You know, that was a very, very kind of traditional, I guess, Jewish pursuit, almost a necessary Jewish pursuit because we were locked out of so many other occupations.
I wonder if I have your next short film, because talking about Jewish merchants, there was a group of Jewish merchants in the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries called the Radenites who traveled the whole world from Spain to China. So you're right, you know, that's a Jewish... I guess a Jewish profession for thousands of years really were wandering Jews. What was the most surprising thing you discovered in preparing the film?
Ooh, that is an interesting question. What is the most surprising thing? Well, I think the most surprising thing I discovered in general was the original spark that
triggered
me on this journey.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the very fact of Jewish pirates. I did not know that. Before I read the book by Ed Kritzler,
right,
it's the one book on
the only
Jews
book I think still
yeah.
On Jewish pirates, right?
And that opened up a whole different view of Jewish history and Jewish identity and Jewish culture. And I had the fortune of being in the Caribbean and seeing. I've seen the synagogue in Curacao, so I knew about...
Yeah, beautiful synagogue, by the way.
It is. I knew about Jewish involvement in the, you know, colonization of the New World and finding settlements and trying to kind of get things established. But the extent of it was still unfamiliar to me, and, you know, the idea that piracy was part of that story was really... fascinating.
You know,
and I couldn't shake it. I had to make the movie.
So glad. You know, it's always bothered me that Lafitte, who helped Andrew Jackson defeat the British in the Battle of New Orleans, the French Jewish pirate, is never portrayed as a Jew in any of the films about that story. It's like
that was a piece of research that was kind of interesting. His Jewish identity is questioned because the origin. You know, the most popular source for his Jewish identity is his diary, which says that his grandparents were Jews. But it was recently discovered that his diary was a forgery by a well-known forger who would forge documents that look like diaries and journals of famous people and then sell them as, you know, priceless antiques.
Kind of a literary pirate, if you will.
Kind of, exactly. So now the question is, okay, so this guy came up with this idea. Did he come up with it just because he was clever, or did he know something about Lafitte's biography that, you know, filtered into his forgery? Is it creative writing, or is it inspired by something else? It's certainly possible that Lafitte had Jewish ancestry. But unfortunately, since the one source that verified that turns out to be unreliable, we no longer have clear evidence one way or the other.
Arnaud, where can people go to find your film? And what's the best way to find out more about you?
Best way to find out more about the film is our Facebook page, facebook.com/Jewish Pirates. On the Facebook page, I've got links to where you can buy the DVD or stream the film online. To find out more about me, arnonshore.com, Google my name, and there are a bunch of, there's the website and Facebook pages and all that sort of stuff.
And pirates will show up as well.
Pirates will show up as well, absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Sure. You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
And the film will be available. It's available online now.
It is. We do have a DVD with some director's commentary, with commentary by our pirate expert. DVDs are kind of old-fashioned technology at this point, but people requested them, so we made those available.
Sure.
If you don't want the bonus materials, online versions on Amazon, on a bunch of other websites, and eventually... By the time this airs, it might not be quite there yet, but eventually it'll be available on Amazon Prime. So for Prime subscribers, it'll be freely available there.
Free on Amazon Prime. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
When we come back here on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be Muhammad Al-Samawi, author of The Fox Hunt, a refugee's memoir of coming to America, four strangers, three faiths, and one extraordinary escape to freedom. Do not miss it. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our twojewishradio.com website, top 10 in America. Our playout this morning comes from Shalom Chanoch, the lovely, haunting Ahavat Neurai, the love of my youth. My friends, have a good Lag BaOmer and a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
הייתי ילד בלילות עצוב משוטט לבד לא נתתי לאיש לדעת את היית אהבת נעורי הייתי ילד בימים חולם מנגן ושר מדמה לי שאת שומעת את השיר הראשון בחיי מסתכל לך תרוקדת, מסתובבת ונצמדת רק אני צופה מהצד אני נשאר ואת עוזרת רחוקה לא מתקרבת זיכרון שעולה בי שוב פרדס רטום לילת התניר ואת שהיית אהבת נעורי ולא הייתי איתך כמעט כל כך מעט ואמרת לי שאת נוסעת ואולי לא אראה אותך שוב
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.